Good morning. To those of you who have braved the icy roads because you care about democracy and how you show up in your community, well done, well done. I jumped at the chance to introduce today's speaker because, you know, I think one of the gifts of many of the people who come up to do adult ed for NASA is that this isn't just a scholarly thing for them. It's something that is deep for them. It's real for them. And I would say that is true for many. It is especially true for Heath Carter, and I get to see it up close. I like to tell the story that when Heath was getting his PhD, we had some colleagues of his over for dinner. One of his colleagues, who was also in the history department at Notre Dame, her husband was getting his PhD in math and philosophy, and his dissertation was on the imaginary zero. And I was like, oh, I'm out. Like, cannot. And I consider myself really lucky that I find the work that Heath does around the history of Christianity in America, and specifically how church communities like this one have been able to make change over the long sweep of U.S. history, is something that I find deeply relevant in my everyday life, and I think you will in yours. So Heath serves as the associate professor of Christianity, U.S. Christianity, American Christianity, something like that. But here at Princeton Seminary, he is a treasure, and I have delivered him to you well today. He is not sick. But before we bring him up, join me in a word of prayer. God, we are so grateful that in the midst of the cold weather outside, we have a warm room to sit and think and gather together and be community in this space, and imagine how we can be community in the space outside of Nassau Presbyterian Church. We thank you for the gift and the call it is to be your people in a broken and hurting world, and we ask that you give us the eyes to see and the ears to hear what you are asking of this in this moment. God, we thank you for the gift of this day. In your name we pray, amen.
Good morning. Good to be with you. Thanks for braving the ice and snow. Is this too loud or is it okay?
It's not too loud.
Okay, that's okay. All right. Yeah, great to be with you all. Obviously in a time, a moment that is a challenging one for many folks. And so I come into the room with a spirit of listening also and eager to have conversation. I know that we bring different things into this room. Not everyone thinks the same about what's happening right now. Not everyone's having the same kind of response to current events. History's not going to provide us with all the answers. I'm a historian, obviously, but I do think it can help to orient us, maybe provide important perspective on the moment that we're in right now. So I hope over the course of this time together to kind of spark some imagining and think together in a hopeful register about the sense of our small effort here at Nassau Presbyterian Church. My sense as a historian of the United States is that democracy in this country has often been imperiled. We've often been living in dangerous times. The guardrails have often been insufficient, when not entirely absent. The challenge of forging a nation, a world in which justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream, has most often been taken up in the face of overwhelming odds. So I think as I listen to the news myself, as I talk to folks in my circles, we face, you know, extraordinary challenges in our time. And yet, I'm not certain that those challenges are entirely unprecedented. You often hear the word unprecedented, and I'm not sure that these times are not, in fact, precedented times. And that's not to say that we should be feeling really at ease, but it's to say that there may be sort of lessons to draw on from earlier moments in our history, and I think that at least can be encouraging. Some of you know I'm writing a book right now about Christians in the United States who fought for a more equal church and nation over the course of the century, stretching from the end of Reconstruction through the modern civil rights movement. And that story picks up actually in a really dangerous time, picks up in 1877, one of the country's most awful years. I don't know how much you remember from history class about that year. Talk about dangerous times. Amid an ongoing economic recession, corporations colluded to suppress wages, angering workers who went on strike across the country in a mass movement that in some cases inflicted damage to property. Across the country, working class uprisings, indignation about corporate oppression were met with violence, including in Chicago, where police met a march of peaceful butchers and other workers marching down Halsted Street with guns, fired into a crowd of unarmed workers, fled, reloaded, returned, and fired again in an episode that was immortalized in Harper's Weekly. What happened in Chicago was representative of what happened all over the country that summer as workers who were so upset vandalized railroad property and other property and were often mowed down in the streets without any recourse on the part of the governments of those places. While corporations backed by police and militia amassed power in the North in 1877, white supremacists seized an opening in the South. In the years immediately following the Civil War, radical Republicans in Congress had constructed new constitutional guardrails that outlawed slavery, guaranteed the rights of citizenship and voting to black freedmen. And freed people made good. Sometimes we miss this in our kind of grand narratives of U.S. history. In the wake of the Civil War, there was a kind of revolution in the South, in the former Confederacy. And in fact, a multiracial democracy was taking root in that region, in part because freed people made good on the promise of these new guardrails, founding union leagues, founding Republican Party chapters, founding independent churches all over the South. Black men were in the majority of the state legislature, even in South Carolina, the one-time hotbed of secessionism. But in 1876, there was a contested presidential election, and a corrupt bargain, as it was called, put the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes in the White House. Republicans had been the boosters of these civil rights protections. In return for the withdrawal of federal troops from the states of the former Confederacy. Didn't happen overnight, but these would-be guardrails that were the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments proved in the end completely inadequate to protect the new society that was being born in the South. It's a tragic story that unfolded over the course of decades, actually, because it was so deeply contested by freed people across the South. But white paramilitary violence, the Ku Klux Klan, the withdrawal of federal troops meant that over the course of several decades, a nefarious Jim Crow order took hold across the region and was ratified by the Supreme Court of the United States of America in 1896 in the famous Plessy v. Ferguson decision. A dangerous time. So my book is actually not, I mean, it's set against the backdrop of these kinds of dangerous times. It's a book about how in the shadow of unchecked corporate power and state-sanctioned white supremacy, the believers of yesteryear built movements for a better tomorrow. I think like our moment, their moment was marked by faltering faith in institutions of all kinds, by a sense that the churches were irrelevant, disconnected from the concerns of ordinary people. It was a time of remarkable division, a time of unbelievable polarization. It was a time when the drumbeat of anti-immigrant sentiment was quickening with waves of assault on Chinese workers across the West, the passing of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, battles between workers and militias were commonplace, not just in 1877. Lynchings of freed people across the South in the late 19th and early 20th century. Deeply divided doesn't begin to describe the reality of the nation in that moment, and really neither does dangerous. Again, not to say that should make us feel at home in the present moment, but it's just by way of context to say there are precedents for the challenges that we face in this moment. What I definitely don't want to say today is that things never change. I don't believe that either. Quite the contrary. In my sort of time with you today, I want to suggest that in the shadows of these dangerous times, believers of an earlier day built movements, did small, faithful things, and helped to create a different kind of society, a society that better reflected the nation's commitment to liberty and justice for all. And so it's in that spirit that I want to kind of situate this moment as having precedence, both in terms of its dangers, but also in terms of the possibilities of small acts of faithfulness. And that's what I want to lead with today. It's Black History Month. Everybody in the room, I think, will be familiar with the kind of most significant moments of the Civil Rights Movement. You remember, we've all learned in school about the late summer of 1963, when Dr. King stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, looking out at hundreds of thousands of persons gathered on the National Mall and declared, "I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." We all know these kind of big moments of the Civil Rights Movement, but the reality of the Civil Rights Movement is that it was powered really, first and foremost, by ordinary people that none of us really, for the most part, have ever heard of. People that were not famous, people that were not, did not have ready access to lots of power of a traditional kind. I think immediately of Amelia Boynton Robinson. Some of you may have heard me talk about Amelia Boynton Robinson before. How many of you have heard of her? Couple of you, for me and a few others. I'll never forget being in Selma, Alabama, almost 10 years ago, next month, March 2015. From Thursday evening, a huge crowd packed into Tabernacle Baptist Church in Selma for the beginning of the 50th Jubilee anniversary of that town's world-changing Bloody Sunday March. In the front rows of the church, I was there. I was working at the time at Valparaiso University and was there with a crowd of students from the university. We were on a kind of civil rights pilgrimage. I was there with a colleague who had studied this and taught this history. It was a remarkable experience to be in Selma 50 years after a world-changing event. In the front row were these older now activists who had been leaders of the movement in the 1960s, and the sanctuary was full of hundreds of others as well. Every seat was taken. It was a standing room only crowd, lines down the aisle and out the door. Unbelievable service of singing choir, gospel choir, had everyone moving to the tune of these civil rights songs. Unbelievable speakers. It was a kind of raucous, jubilant occasion. Suddenly, I was sitting up in the balcony up here with my students and craned my neck over the balcony to see what was going on because it got really quiet in the church. I finally saw that they were wheeling an elderly woman into the sanctuary, and I realized that that was Amelia Boynton Robinson, 103 years old. She's not one of the household names of the Civil Rights Movement. When I ask my students who they know from civil rights history, she has yet to come up. But she played a key role in the civil rights movement in this country. She was a Tabernacle Baptist that night because of that role. I'm not sure how many of you will remember the details of what happened in Selma, but a quick review. In the early 1960s in Dallas County, Alabama, desperately poor part of Alabama in that day and in our own. If you've been to Selma, it is a really poor town today. This is part of a larger story to dive into about the ongoing challenges of civil rights and equality in this country. In the 1960s, though, African Americans constituted more than half of the population, but fewer than 2% of the registered voters. In January of 1964, Amelia Boynton reached out to Martin Luther King Jr. to ask him and his Southern Christian Leadership Conference to support local efforts to get people registered to vote in Selma and the surrounding area. They accepted and used her home as their local headquarters. That same spring, Boynton declared a run for Congress, a decision that underscored her remarkable courage. She was the first woman, white or black, to run for Congress in Alabama, and the first black person to run for Congress in the state since Reconstruction. She got 10% of the vote in 1964. As civil rights activism increased in that part of the country, so did the backlash against it. On February 18, 1965, if you've seen the Selma film, this is depicted in that film, in nearby Marion, a short drive from Selma, state troopers clubbed voting rights activists and fatally shot 26-year-old Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was, as depicted in that film, trying to protect his own mother from being assaulted by state troopers. Local civil rights leaders who no one had ever heard of at the time, Hosea Williams, John Lewis, Amelia Boynton, young people, people unheard of, people like you and I, planned a march to Montgomery to express their indignation and their demand for voting rights to Governor George Wallace. And on March 7th, they set out from the humble homes across the street from one of the churches in downtown Selma. They marched from those housing projects across the street from Brown Chapel, another big site of the movement like Tabernacle Baptist, through downtown Selma and onto the Edmund Pettus Bridge. If you've been to Selma, you know the Edmund Pettus Bridge, it's got like kind of an arc to it, so you can't see on the other side as you're coming up the bridge. They got to the top of the bridge, all seemed well, but at the top they could see down below line after line of state troopers wearing white helmets and billy clubs. Behind them were deputies of the county sheriff, Jim Clark, and assorted spectators waving Confederate flags and anticipating a showdown. 50 feet from the troopers, the marchers stopped. "It would be detrimental to your safety to continue this march," Major John Cloud called out from his bullhorn. "This is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue." Hosea Williams replied, "Mr. Major, I'd like to have a word. Can we have a word?" "Got nothing further to say to you," Cloud answered. And a moment later, the onslaught began. Donning gas masks, the troopers, many on horseback, pushed forward, unleashing a rain of tear gas and billy clubs on the protesters. Amelia Boynton was knocked unconscious by their blows. She was one of 17 of the marchers who had to be hospitalized that day. Dr. King had stayed in his church in Atlanta on Bloody Sunday and planned to join the marchers en route to Montgomery. He returned to Selma after Bloody Sunday and led a march 2 days later that, as again depicted in the film, turned back when demonstrators once more found themselves confronted by state troopers on the other side of the bridge. Finally, 2 weeks later, on March 21st, in the face of mounting public pressure, Governor Wallace relented, allowing the marchers to pass. By the time they arrived in Montgomery, their number was 25,000 strong. This was a major turning point, not just in the history of the modern United States, but in the history of the modern world. The footage was shown all over the world. Soviets responded with glee to the footage of peaceful protesters being beaten by the authorities. "Look at how the beacon of democracy treats its very own citizens," they said. President Lyndon B. Johnson scurried to respond, and sure enough, in the face of mounting public pressure that began with a ragtag band of ordinary folks, on August 6, 1965, Amelia Boynton was a guest of honor at the White House when President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. He memorably invoked the lyrics of a great civil rights anthem, declaring as he signed, "And we shall overcome." Boynton played a significant role in those breakthroughs, so it was really remarkable, inspiring to be there 50 years later at Tabernacle Baptist and to watch several days after that as she crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge one more time, holding the hand of the nation's first black president, expectant hopes for a new day dawning. I still haven't told you the part of Boynton's story that I find most remarkable. She didn't begin this work in 1964. She began it in the early 1930s. At a moment in the history of Alabama and the United States of America when she had no rational reason whatsoever to believe that she would ever see the fruits of her labors. That at some future date, the national media would descend on this small town in this poor county in the state of Alabama. She had no rational reason to believe. In fact, it would have been safe to say it would have been crazy almost to believe that there would be a day she would find herself at a White House signing ceremony. All that to most mere mortals would seem completely far-fetched. In the 1930s, Boynton had much more reason to believe she could pay the ultimate price for even trying to make a change. But try she did. Boynton met her husband, Samuel William Boynton, in 1930, and together they traveled the countryside, teaching black sharecroppers cutting-edge farming techniques and holding meetings in rural churches where they went through the process of registering folks to vote, even in the face of poll taxes and impossible exams. In the mid-1930s, Boynton wanted to build a community center, given that the only one Selma had excluded black residents. She failed to get government funding, and so she wrote a musical through the years set to the tune of black spirituals. In 1933, she and a local pastor co-founded the Dallas County Voters League, and for the next 3 decades, she continued to conduct voter registration drives, an anonymous woman in a poor town where black people lived under radical oppression with no guardrails. She conducted those voter drives for 3 decades with very little success, almost none. But she never gave up on hope through all those years in the 1930s, in the 1940s, in the 1950s, into the 1960s, when this unbelievable, unpredictable thing happened, and suddenly, in the course of 6 months, the possibilities shifted, everything changed. Boynton had a sign in her office that read, "A voteless people is a hopeless people." And that was part of what kept her going day in, day out, doing the small, faithful thing right in front of her when it seemed like surely, at the end of the day, it could make no difference. When I teach about Boynton, I often marvel that a remarkable life is evidence for the working of the Holy Spirit. How else to explain her courage, not to mention her hope and faith in the possibility of a different world, even when there seems so little reason to suppose that that was possible? And when prudence might have counseled one to just keep one's head down, survive, to give up hope altogether. Part of what I believe, part of what I, you know, this is one story. There are so many stories. Let me just tell you a few others, and then I want to open it up. Boynton was joined, of course, by countless other remarkable folks. Fannie Lou Hamer is a little better known than Amelia Boynton Robinson, but another person whose faith seemed to be in the possibility of a different world and in the kind of momentous possibilities of a small faithful act. For Fannie Lou Hamer, it was often, she was a civil rights activist who led through song and made This Little Light of Mine, a song that could be kind of a theme for this talk, an anthem of the civil rights movement. Hamer was in Mississippi in the summer of 1964. At the same time, Boynton and company were mobilizing and organizing in Selma in Mississippi during Freedom Summer. Hamer was there with civil rights activists from all over the country who had come to Mississippi in response to this call for help. She was arrested with a group of other civil rights activists, put in jail in Winona, Mississippi, brutally beaten by prison guards, cruelly tortured, never fully recovered physically from the beating that she took that night in Mississippi. She actually didn't live a long life. But that night in the jail, she started singing. And the sound of her voice soon rung out through the whole cell block. And everybody soon in that cell block, all those activists were singing together. That was the spirit, the sort of boundless spirit of faith that Fannie Lou Hamer and the fellow activists whose work, again, in the sort of face of seemingly impossible odds, they believed in small acts of faithfulness in dangerous times. I don't know how many of you have seen this film Of Gods and Men. It's a film, it's a French film. It's about a community of monks in Algeria in a time of rising in this community extremism. And it's a really interesting film. I'd recommend it. It's sort of on the theme here of this talk in many ways as well. It's different. It's a beautiful film. It's a very slow film. A lot of what they do in the film is they show you just the daily rhythms of life in this monastery. So it's very slow. It's very beautiful. They film the liturgies, the prayer times, the meals. But the drama at the heart of the film is this question of whether or not in the time, as the conditions around these monks are becoming more and more dangerous, should they leave? And it's a subject of great contention in this community. I won't give away what happens in the film, but one of the things that's really, I think, one of the more remarkable moments, a kind of key moment in the film, is when the monks, which are, they're really embedded, they're not siloed off, they're embedded in this community. It's a predominantly Muslim community. They are very active in small, faithful ways in the community. And there's a moment where, in the presence of some of the folks who are living in the same neighborhood as them, they're debating about whether or not to stay or to go. And one of the monks says aloud, "We're like birds on a branch." And one of the folks from the community says, "No, you are the branch. We are the birds. You're the branch." And underscores the ways in which their small acts of faithfulness have created like a deep well of goodness. It thickens the plot of their discernment about whether to stay or whether to go. I'd recommend the film. Some of you know the story of Sister Helen Prejean, who became famous for her role in the, you know, being sort of featured in the film Dead Man Walking. She came to Valpo when I was teaching there, and, you know, she's a famous person, but she wasn't always famous. She was once just a regular person, and who got caught up in conversation with someone on death row. And that little conversation and her sense of commitment to this single person right in front of her has led her into a life of challenge, advocacy, and struggle around questions around death row. She came to Valpo when I was teaching there and talked movingly about her experience kind of first getting involved with activism around the death penalty. But she also then talked about the ongoing journey and struggle and the ways that she was challenged after the fact, after the film, by victims' families, and the ways in which she came to realize that she, in fact, hadn't fully understood or empathized with their experiences as well, and the journey that she went on, a journey that was one small act of faithfulness at a time that's led her into a life of great impact. Some of you know Dorothy Day, like another sort of potential patron saint of a talk like this one. Day founded the Catholic Worker Movement in New York City in a dangerous time, the 1930s. She's a wild figure in terms of, you know, she was somebody who deeply believed in the church. She deeply believed in the kind of radical call of Jesus to live with and for the poor. She never embraced, she rejected any whiff of a strategic plan. She rejected any whiff of like, we have to figure out how to address the challenges of our time. She's like, no, we got to feed this person right here in front of us. Later in her life, in the 1960s, she collected some of her writings into a book called Loaves and Fishes, which I also recommend to you for a time like this. And in that book, she was getting older. She started this paragraph, said, "Young people say, what can one person do? What is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we can only lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. We can be responsible only for the one action of the present moment, but we can beg for an increase of love in our hearts that will vitalize and transform these actions and know that God will take them and multiply them as Jesus multiplied the loaves and the fishes." Something along those lines, I think, is really key to, as I think about the sweep of history and how to be faithful in dangerous times, it's so easy to be overwhelmed by all that we can't do. But there's wisdom, I think, in doing the small faithful thing right in front of us. And if you believe Dorothy Day, you never know where it might go. You never know how it might be infectious. You never know how it might inspire someone else. You never know what God might do in our midst. When I lived in Valpo, I was involved with an organization called Project Neighbors. This is Greg Jones and Loie Reiner. Loie's 95 years old now. She was part of this small community in this small town in Northwest Indiana, a place that many people have never heard of, who were at a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the more conservative branch of American Lutheranism. Kind of before developments in that larger denomination. But in the 1960s, a group of folks in that small congregation, in that small town, decided that it was long past time that Valparaiso, Indiana, ceased to be a sundown town, which it had been. And they got organized, and as Loie would say, and it's very much in the same spirit as Dorothy Day, one thing led to another. And they are now, this group of folks, they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s now. They need to find some opportunities to transition this organization. But this organization is the largest provider, one of the largest providers of affordable housing in the entire region. It's an organization literally powered by a band of local folks in a congregation that also helped to found the largest nonprofit health clinic in the state of Indiana. It started off as a free clinic in the poorest part of the city of Valparaiso. It started with small acts of faithfulness, and as Loie likes to say, one thing led to another. Well, I'm wrapping up here. Maybe one more story. I had an opportunity a few years ago to visit with a community of sisters in Grand Rapids who had implemented the living wage in their community. They have a big campus, kind of like a small college situation, and it started with a couple sisters who really believed in Catholic social teaching around the living wage, and they knew they weren't paying it. And they went to the CFO, and they talked to the CFO, who had a corporate background, about living wage, and she was like, this is crazy. This isn't feasible. And over the course of their time together, they built relationship with one another and talked about the moral call to pay employees a living wage, to live with integrity in their own tradition. And the CFO she actually talked about it with me as like a kind of conversion. She said, we just have to do this. This is what our tradition says. And because of the small acts of witness, the small acts of faithfulness, in that community in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that community pays their employees a living wage. It makes a huge difference in the lives of the people that they employ. I got to do one more thing, and I'm seriously done. Many of you know the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, which sprung up in a time of crisis, a refugee crisis from Latin America. That movement was powered by mostly people you've never heard of before. One of the hubs of it in Tucson, Arizona, I had a chance to visit a few years ago, was a small Presbyterian church, Southside Presbyterian Church, that at that point had a fraction of the people that go to this church and a fraction of the resources of this church. And that through the course of a couple of, you know, they had proximity to people who were suffering. There were people that died in the desert, crossing the desert in the summer in the early 1980s near Tucson. They were connected to a deportation, prison complex, a deportation, and they knew folks who were working there, and they decided to make a stand. And suddenly this small church that literally had like 60 people in it came to the center of an international controversy over immigration law in the United States, and helped to inspire a movement that before it was all said and done would involve thousands of churches all over the country and world, folks who felt called to live out the gospel in their time through small acts of faithfulness. You never know what can happen. You never know what can be infectious. times are often dangerous. We don't get to control, we don't get to decide what happens in some big picture level. But the small, faithful thing right in front of us, if you do that, you never know what might happen. I'm going to stop there. We have a little time to talk. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, Heath. I noticed that almost everyone you mentioned was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah. Women have often been the both powered churches and powered social movements. And I think in my field, we've not often been good about highlighting that. And so I do try to do that when I talk about stuff. But I think it's just the reality that if you're interested in American religious history, as one of my colleagues wrote, American religious history is women's history. And it always has been. Women have always been the majority in the pews. They've always been leading some of the most important initiatives. They've not had access to the formal clergy and roles of traditional power within churches and denominations until last generation. But they've played critical roles on the ground in communities, carrying it in the domestic world, but also far beyond for their communities. And they're many of my inspirations. Yeah.
You mentioned the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and how they were insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck by that because I wonder in the moment they pass and they seem like permanent victories.
Yeah.
And yet, I wonder if you could say a bit more about why they were insufficient.
Well, I think that's the thing that I think is really interesting, right? And why I said I don't like the takeaway to be that nothing ever changes. Because actually, in the moment when those amendments passed, they were revolutionary. And they helped to give birth to a new founding of a kind in the South, where people were able to take advantage of those. There is always a push and pull in history. We're living through one of those moments right now, I think, of this push and pull, right? I mean, Amelia Boynton helped to get the Voting Rights Act passed, and then live to see in 2013 the Supreme Court gut that act and a new wave of voter suppression rise up in the wake of the gutting of that act. And so, you know, part of what I think is true is in this world, on this side of the veil, like, victories are not permanent, but they really matter. So people's, like, history, if you look at U.S. history, like, things have been better and things have been worse. And in the context of even one lifetime, in the context of Ida B. Wells was born into the world of this new founding, and as a young woman saw the curtain of Jim Crow come down, and by the end of her life saw the glimmers of the movement that would lead to the signing of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. All that happened in the context of one life. So that's the stakes of our small acts of faithfulness for me, is things can be genuinely better and genuinely worse. The takeaway is not things are always the same. They're not always the same. So the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments, you know, they were not sufficient in that moment, but they would become critical again, right? A century later in the monumental legislation of the 1960s. And they've been critical for Supreme Court jurisprudence. So victories, I mean, the other thing that I believe is that you kind of leave the breadcrumbs, this tradition, you build a tradition that also, even if in the 1890s those amendments didn't prove sufficient to forestall an unbelievably vicious, violent backlash to civil rights, they would be critical again. So the victories that were won to get those amendments passed weren't all for naught by the 1890s. They would come in huge again later in the 20th century. Yeah. Molly.
Thank you for that. I really enjoyed your talk.
Thanks.
It was completely comprehensible.
Okay. I'm so glad.
My question, I struggle, what is my brick that I can lay? Mm-hmm. What can I do? And I ask you, what is your brick beyond teaching at the seminary and raising your family? What is the thing you think you might try to do?
In this moment? That's a great question. I don't have a ready answer to that in terms of, I mean, I was talking with some friends last night about, like, how we're thinking about this moment and how we're processing it. I don't I don't have a sense of like, this is the one thing that I need to do right now, or this is the one thing that you need to do. I don't know that it comes like that either, you know? I think often if I take this sort of history seriously, that we need to listen to folks who've already been doing good work in our communities. Sometimes the thing to do is to join that work. Sometimes the thing to do is to get connected to people who have been doing work for a long time, and not to enter in and believe like we've got to start a new thing. That's one thought I have, you know. Sometimes it's like going to school board meetings, going to local. I mean, I believe in local. I've been really, at various points in my adult life, really involved in local civic life. And I think that's a place of great possibility for us in terms of like shaping our own communities. And you never know what can happen when you get involved in your own community and where that might lead, what that might make possible. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to try to make this a clear question, and it really has to do with sort of the shared reality in the country and a sense of what the Christian faith is. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in the 1960s we still had, for example, 3 networks. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the internet.
Yeah.
And I also think that in the 1960s, I know the Southern churches preached, you know, they grounded their racism mm-hmm. in the Bible. Mm-hmm. But that was the Southern churches. And now we're in a vastly different mm-hmm. sort of world yeah. in terms of the reality, the mm-hmm. facts. Mm-hmm. And also the sense of what the Christian faith is. And yep. I guess I'll use the prayer service when Reverend Booty or
yeah.
made yeah. her amazing statement and yeah. got it was broadcast mm-hmm. everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I saw someone online who said, you know, I've been an atheist, but if that's what Christianity is, I'm a Christian.
Yeah.
And so I just would ask for your thoughts about mm-hmm. how we mm-hmm. think about that. Yeah.
Well, in some ways, that moment in the mid-20th century is an unusual moment in the history of the country, where there really has not historically been 3, you know, Walter Cronkite wasn't like beamed into every living room. Like, that kind of reality is that's really the exception to the rule. So in the period that I was talking about earlier, the late 19th century, I mean, that's a period of like penny papers and you know, every unbelievably amounts of different kinds of perspectives and journalism that's not always very reliable. So again, I think it's an important point of contrast between our moment and the mid-20th century moment. But, you know, you could look throughout the history more broadly and find lots of precedents for the kind of information ecosystem that we're living in today. You know, and I think in that day, in the 1960s, and in ours, there is a lot of disagreement over what the meaning of Christianity is for public life. And it's certainly the case, like, we are living in a time now, so I'm writing a book that kind of ends in the 70s, where you see the high water mark of a Christianity that believed that fights against structural inequality were key to being faithful. And that I believe that tradition changed the nation. And the kind of story that I've told you about the civil rights movement and the labor movements and whatnot, those are outgrowths of that tradition. There's a backlash against that thing, and there's a lot of investment in a different kind of Christian tradition that we live in the shadow of in many ways, a story that unfolds in the 1980s and 90s and that has earlier roots, but that was not triumphant in the 1960s and 70s. I don't think that the fundamental idea, I mean, I think the kind of intuition that the thing to do in a moment like this is still to do the small faithful thing right in front of you. I don't think any of these things change that fundamental insight, which I think actually runs really deep in the Christian tradition. And the idea that we get to plan and control and decide kind of the shape of the big thing, I don't know that that really runs nearly as deep. And so as hard as it is in dangerous times to like focus on the small thing, I haven't given up on hope. I think our faith tells us that justice wins in the end, that there is a beautiful day coming. And I do believe that. And I believe that in the meanwhile, the best we can do is a small faithful thing right in front of us, and that it might be infectious, and that things might change in ways, like things that seem very solid can change. And that's part of what I think the message of history across periods can be, is that things that seem very solid can change, that people who have lots of power but not lots of wisdom, they don't always get their way. They don't always anticipate what might happen with the consequences of their actions, right? There's ironies, there's unexpected consequences, there's all kinds of possibilities that, I don't know. So that's what I hold on to. I don't know that there's anything, I mean, for me, I listen to media myself where, you know, it can feel like we're being called to live in constant fear. And I'm not clear that that will help any of the things that we care about to take deeper root. So how do we, on the one hand, guard against real danger and hold on to the possibilities that a different world can be? And that to me is like the tension to live in this time, is like guarding against real danger while holding on to the hope of a world that our faith tells us is really coming. It's hard, yeah.
Heath is going to stick around. He's here for the whole coffee hour, but we do have to wrap up so we can move things around. Thank you so much, Heath, and I hope that you all will join us next week. Dr. Hamunda Barreto is going to be here talking about liberation Christianity through a Latin American lens. So thank you all for your good attention today.
Thank you.